in the State Department at the time in this way. Latin Americans were making the wrong choices. They were calling, I'm quoting now, they were calling for policies designed to bring about a broader distribution of wealth and to raise the standard of living of the masses, and they were convinced that the first beneficiaries of a country's resources should be the people of that country, not U.S. investors. That's unacceptable, so sovereignty cannot be allowed. They can have freedom, but freedom to make the right choices. That message has been regularly and forcefully reaffirmed in case after case up to the present. Just to mention a couple of examples, Guatemala had a brief interlude of democracy. It was ended, as you know, by a U.S. military coup. For the public, this was presented as defense against the Russians. A little bit exotic, but that was the story. Internally, the thrust was different, and the threat was seen more realistically. Here's the way it was seen. The social and economic programs of the elected government met the aspirations of labor and the peasantry, inspired the loyalty, and conformed to the self-interest of most politically conscious Guatemalans, and worse still, the broad social programs of aiding the workers and the peasants in a victorious struggle against the upper classes and large foreign enterprises has a strong appeal to the populations of Central American neighbors where similar conditions prevail. So therefore, a military solution was necessary. It's been going on for 40 years, and it's left the same culture of terror as in Central American neighbors. Same was true in Cuba, another currently live case. When the United States made the decision to overthrow the government of Cuba in 1960, the reasoning was very similar. It was explained by historian Arthur Schlesinger, who summarized to President Kennedy the study of a Latin American mission in a secret report to the incoming president. The Cuban threat, according to the mission, was the spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into one's own hands. That's a disease that might infect the rest of Latin America, where the poor and underprivileged, which means almost everyone, stimulated by the example of the Cuban Revolution, are now demanding opportunities for a decent living. So something has to be done, and you know what was done. What about the Soviet connection? That was actually mentioned in the report. The Soviet Union hovers in the wings, flourishing large development loans and presenting itself as the model for achieving modernization in a single generation. Well, that's the threat of taking their lives into their own hands. And it had to be destroyed by terrorism and economic strangulation, which is still continuing. All of that is totally independent of the Cold War, as surely is obvious by now, even without the secret record. The same concerns in the post-Cold War period led to the quick undermining of Haiti's brief experiment in democracy by Presidents Bush and Clinton, continuing an earlier record. The same concerns lie in the background of the trade agreements, so NAFTA, for example. At the time of NAFTA, you'll recall, the propaganda was that it was going to be a wonderful boon to working people in all three countries, Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Well, that was quietly abandoned shortly after when the facts were in. And what was obvious all along was, in fact, finally publicly conceded, publicly. The goal was to, quoting, to lock Mexico into the reforms of the 1980s, reforms which had sharply reduced wages, enriched a small sector and foreign investors. The background concerns were articulated at a Latin American Strategy Development Conference in Washington, a workshop which in 1990, it warned that a democracy opening in Mexico could bring into office a government more interested in challenging the United States on economic and nationalist grounds. Notice that's the same threat as in 1945 and since, overcome in this case by locking Mexico into treaty obligations. These same reasons consistently lie behind a half a century of torture and terror, not only in the Western Hemisphere, and they're also at the core of the investor rights agreements that are being imposed under the specific form of globalization that's designed by state corporate power nexus. Well, okay, let's go back to the contested issue of freedom and rights, hence sovereignty, insofar as it's to be valued. Do they inhere in persons of flesh and blood, or only in small sectors of wealth and privilege, or even in abstract constructions like corporations or capital, or states? In the past century, the idea that such entities have special rights over and above persons has been very strongly advocated. The most prominent examples are Bolshevism, fascism, and private corporatism, which is a form of privatized tyranny. Two of these systems have collapsed. The third is alive and flourishing under the banner TINA. There's no alternative to the emerging system of state corporate mercantilism disguised with various mantras like globalization and free trade. Now, a century ago, during the early stages of the corporatization of America, discussion about these matters was quite frank. Conservatives a century ago denounced the procedure, the corporatization, as a return to feudalism and a form of communism, which is not an entirely inappropriate analogy. There were similar intellectual origins in neo-Hegelian ideas about the rights of organic entities and the belief in the need to have a centralized administration of chaotic systems like the markets, which were totally out of control. It's worth bearing in mind that in today's so-called free trade economy, a very large component of cross-border transactions, which are called trade misleadingly, probably about 70% of them, are actually within centrally managed institutions, within corporations and corporate alliances. It's quite apart from all kinds of other radical market distortions. The conservative critique, notice that conservatives in the sense that this is a traditional notion of conservative. They don't exist anymore. But in a century ago, there were conservatives. The conservative critique was echoed at the liberal progressive end of the spectrum early in the 20th century, most notably perhaps by John Dewey, America's leading social philosopher. His work focused largely on democracy, and he argued that democratic forms have little substance when the life of the country, production, commerce, media, are ruled by private tyrannies in a system of what he called industrial feudalism, in which working people are subordinated to managerial control and politics becomes the shadow cast by big business over society. Interestingly, progressive intellectuals who favored the process of corporatization agreed more or less with this description. So Woodrow Wilson, for example, he wrote that corporatization is creating a new America in which small groups of men in control of great corporations wield power and control over the wealth and business opportunity of the country, in which most men are servants of corporations, not free men as in the old America that's gone, and corporations are becoming rivals of government itself, undermining popular sovereignty exercised through the democratic political system. Similar questions, very similar ones, are very much alive in the international arena today that talk about, you know, reforming financial architecture and that sort of thing. A century ago, right about that time, corporations were granted the rights of persons by radical judicial activism. It's an extreme violation of classical liberal principles. They were also freed from earlier obligations to keep to specific activities for which they were chartered. Furthermore, in an important move, the courts shifted power upwards from the stockholders in a partnership to the central management, which was identified with the immortal corporate person. Those of you who are familiar with the history of communism will recognize that this is very similar to the process that was taking place at the time, very quickly, predicted, in fact, by left critics, left Marxist and anarchist critics of Bolshevism, people like Rosa Luxemburg, who warned early on that the centralizing ideology would shift power from working people to the party, to the Central Committee, and then to the Maximal Leader, as happened very quickly after the conquest of state power in 1917, which at once destroyed every residue of socialist forms and principles. The propagandists on both sides prefer a different story for self-serving reasons, but I think that's the accurate one. In recent years, corporations have been granted rights that go far beyond those of persons. So under the World Trade Organization rules, corporations can demand what's called the right of national treatment. That means that, say, General Motors, if it's operating in Mexico, can demand the right of, can demand to be treated like a Mexican firm. Now, that's only a right of the immortal persons. It's not a right of flesh and blood persons. Like a Mexican can't come to New York and demand national treatment. Won't do very well. Other rules, but corporations can. Other rules require that the rights of investors, lenders, speculators, they must prevail over the rights of mere flesh and blood people, generally, undermining popular sovereignty and diminishing democratic rights. Corporations, as I'm sure you know, even have the right to bring suits, bring actions against sovereign states. And there are interesting cases. For example, Guatemala, a couple of years ago, sought to reduce infant mortality by regulating the marketing of infant formula by multinationals. The measures that Guatemala proposed were in conformity with World Health Organization guidelines, and they kept to international codes, but the Gerber Corporation claimed expropriation, and the threat of a World Trade Organization complaint sufficed for Guatemala to withdraw, fearing retaliatory sanctions by the United States. Actually, the first such complaint under the World Trade Organization rules, the new World Trade Organization, was brought against the United States by Venezuela and Brazil, who complained that EPA regulations on petroleum violated their rights as petroleum exporters. Washington backed down that time, also allegedly in fear of sanctions, but I'm skeptical about that interpretation. I don't think the U.S. fears trade sanctions from Venezuela and Brazil. More likely, the Clinton administration simply saw no compelling reason to defend environmental, the environment and protect health. These issues are arising very dramatically and, in fact, obscenely right now. Tens of millions of people around the world are dying from treatable diseases because of the protectionist elements written into the World Trade Organization rules grant private mega corporations monopoly pricing rights. So Thailand and South Africa, for example, which have pharmaceutical industries, can produce life-saving drugs at a fraction of the cost of the monopolistic pricing, but they're afraid to do so under threat of trade sanctions. In fact, 1998, the United States even threatened the World Health Organization that it would withdraw funding if the World Health Organization even monitored the effects of trade conditions on health. These are very real threats. I'm talking about today, like, you know, this week's international press. All of this is called trade rights. It has nothing to do with trade. It has to do with monopolistic pricing practices enforced by protectionist measures that are introduced into free trade agreements, what are called free trade agreements. The measures are designed to ensure corporate rights. They also have the effect of reducing growth and innovation, naturally, and they are only part of the array of regulations which introduced into these agreements, which are an attempt to prevent development and growth, not economically motivated. What is at stake is investor rights and not trade, and trade, of course, itself is, you know, has no value in itself. It's of value if it increases human welfare, otherwise not. Well, in general, the principle of the World Trade Organization, the primary principle and related treaties, is that sovereignty and democratic rights have to be subordinated to the rights of investors. In practice, that means the rights of the huge immortal persons, the private tyrannies, to which people must be subordinated. These are among the issues that led to the remarkable events in Seattle, but in some ways, a lot of ways, the conflict between popular sovereignty and private power was illuminated more sharply a couple of months after Seattle, just a few weeks ago in Montreal, where an ambiguous settlement was reached on the so-called biosafety protocols. There the issue was very clearly drawn. Quote the New York Times, a compromise was reached after intense negotiations that often pitted the United States against almost everyone else over what's called the precautionary principle. What's that? Well, the chief negotiator for the European Union, quoting him, countries must have the freedom, the sovereign right, to take precautionary measures with regard to genetically altered seed, microbes, animals, crops that they fear might be harmful. The United States, however, insisted on World Trade Organization rules. Those rules are that an import can be banned only on the basis of scientific evidence. Notice what's at stake here. The question is at stake is whether people have the right to refuse to be experimental subjects. So to personalize it, suppose the biology department at the university were to walk in and tell you, you folks have to be experimental subjects in an experiment we're carrying out where we're going to, I don't know what, stick electrodes in your brain and see what happens. You can refuse, but only if you provide scientific evidence that it's going to harm you. Well, you know, usually you can't provide scientific evidence. The question is, do you have a right to refuse? Under World Trade Organization rules, you don't. You have to be experimental subjects. It's a form of what Ed Herman, a co-author of mine as an economist, has called producer sovereignty. The producer reigns. Consumers have to somehow defend themselves. That works domestically, too, as he pointed out. It's not the responsibility of, say, chemical and pesticide industries to prove that what they're putting into the environment is safe. It's the responsibility of the public to prove scientifically that it's unsafe. And they have to do this through underfunded public agencies that are susceptible to industry influence through lobbying and other pressures. That was the issue at Montreal, and a kind of ambiguous settlement was reached. Notice, to be clear, there was no issue of principle. You can see that by just looking at the lineup. The United States was on one side, and it was joined, in fact, by some other countries with a stake in biotechnology and agro export, high-tech agro export. And on the other side, you had everybody else, those who didn't expect to profit by the experiment. That was the lineup, and that tells you exactly how much principle was involved. For similar reasons, the European Union favors high tariffs on agricultural products, just as the United States did 40 years ago, but no longer, and not because the principles have changed, just because power has changed. There is an overriding principle. The principle is that the powerful and the privileged have to be able to do what they want, of course, pleading high motives. The corollary is that sovereignty and democratic rights of people must go. In this case, and that's what makes it so dramatic, their reluctance to be experimental subjects when U.S.-based corporations can profit by the experiment. The U.S. appeal to the World Trade Organization rules is very natural, since they codify that principle. That's the point. These issues, although they're very real and affecting a huge number of people in the world, are actually secondary to other modalities to reduce sovereignty in favor of private power. Most important, I think, surely, was the dismantling of the Bretton Woods system in the early 1970s by the United States and Britain and others. That system was designed by the U.S. and Britain in the 1940s. It was a time of overwhelming popular support for social welfare programs and radical democratic measures. And primarily for those reasons, this is very explicit, incidentally, not inference, primarily for those reasons, the Bretton Woods system of the mid-40s regulated exchange rates The idea was to cut down wasteful and harmful speculation, and it permitted countries to restrict capital flow. And the reasons were well understood and clearly articulated. Free capital flow creates what's sometimes called a virtual parliament of global capital, which can exercise veto power over government policies that it considers irrational. That means things like labor rights or educational programs or health or efforts to stimulate the economy, or in fact anything that might help people and not profits and therefore is irrational in the technical sense. The Bretton Woods system more or less functioned for about 25 years. That's what many economists call the golden age of modern capitalism, modern state capitalism more accurately. That was a period roughly up until about 1970, a period of quite historically unprecedented rapid growth of the economy, of trade, of productivity, capital investment, extension of welfare state measures, golden age. That was reversed in the early 70s. The Bretton Woods system was dismantled with liberalization of financial markets and floating exchange rates. The period since has often been described as a leaden age, accurately. There was a huge explosion of very short-term speculative capital, completely overwhelming the productive economy. There was quite marked deterioration in just about every respect. Considerably slower economic growth, slower growth of productivity, of capital investment, higher interest, much higher interest rates, which slow down growth, greater market volatility and financial crises. All of these things have very severe human effects. The lenders tend to be bailed out, stagnating and declining wages, much longer working hours, particularly striking in the United States. Just to give one example, in today's great economy that everyone's talking about, the median wage, you know, half above, half below median income, half above, half below, for families has gotten back now to what it was in 1989, which is well below what it was in the 1970s. Also, it's been a period of the dismantling of social democratic measures that had considerably improved human welfare and, in general, provided much greater veto power for the virtual parliament of private capital of investors, leading to a significant decline of democracy and sovereign rights as intended, and a significant deterioration in social health. Well, those effects are felt in the rich societies. They're a catastrophe in the poorer societies. And these issues, they really, you know, they cut across societies. So, you know, it's not a matter of this society got richer and that one got poorer. The more significant measures are sectors of the global population. So, for example, if you take, say, the top 5%, use this recent World Bank analysis, if you take the top 5% of the world's population, compare their income wealth to the bottom 5%, that ratio was 78 to 1 in 1988 and 114 to 1 in 1993. That's the last period for which figures are available and undoubtedly higher now. The same figures, the top 1% of the world's population has the same income as the bottom 57%, 2.5 billion people. For the rich countries, the point was made very clearly, let me quote a good economist, by an economist, Barry Eichengreen, who's a highly regarded history of the international monetary system, and listen to it carefully, has the point correct. Like others, he pointed out, many people have pointed this out, that the current phase of globalization is rather similar to the pre-World War I period by rough measures. However, there are differences, and here they are, main one. At that time, global policy, government policy, had not yet been politicized by universal male suffrage and the rise of trade unionism and parliamentary labor parties. Therefore, the severe human costs of financial rectitude that are imposed by the virtual parliament, they could be transferred to the general population. But that luxury was no longer available in the more democratic Bretton Woods era, 1945, so that limits on capital mobility substituted for limits on democracy as a source of insulation from market pressures. as a corollary to that. It's quite natural that dismantling of the post-war economic order should be accompanied by a significant attack on substantive democracy, freedom, and popular sovereignty and human rights under the slogan PINA. There's no alternative. It's kind of a farcical mimicry of vulgar Marxism. The slogan, needless to say, is self-serving fraud. The particular socioeconomic order that's being imposed is the result of human decisions in human institutions. The decisions can be modified. The institutions can be changed. If necessary, they can be dismantled and replaced, just as honest and courageous people have been doing throughout the course of history. Thanks.
You were just listening to Noam Chomsky on Taking Control of Our Lives. The legendary MIT professor has been called the conscience of the American people. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. And since its inception, AR has been archiving Chomsky's recordings. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Noam Chomsky on Taking Control of Our Lives, and for Chomsky's most recent book, The Myth of American Idealism, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. PDFs and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. And happy birthday, Noam Chomsky.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM. Talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.
podcasting on